Chapter 19. The Lion and the Serpent. Harry felt as though he were carrying some kind of talisman inside his chest over the following 2 weeks. A glowing secret that supported him through Umbridge's classes, and even made it possible for him to smile blandly as he looked into her horrible, bulging eyes. He and the D.A. were resisting her under her very nose, doing the very thing she and the Ministry most feared. And whenever he was supposed to be reading Wilbert Slinkard's book during her lessons, he dwelled instead on satisfying memories of their most recent meetings, remembering how Neville had successfully disarmed Hermione, how Colin Creevy had mastered the impediment jinx after 3 meetings' hard effort, how Parvati Patil had produced such a good reductor curse that she had reduced the table carrying all the sneakerscopes to dust. He was finding it almost impossible to fix a regular night of the week for the DA meetings, as they had to accommodate 3 separate teams' Quidditch practices, which were often rearranged due to bad weather conditions. But Harry was not sorry about this. He had a feeling that it was probably better to keep the timing of their meetings unpredictable. If anyone was watching them, it would be hard to make out a pattern. Hermione soon devised a very clever method of communicating the time and date of the next meeting to all the members, in case they needed to change it at short notice, because it would look suspicious if people from different houses were seen crossing the Great Hall to talk to each other too often. She gave each of the members of the DA a fake galleon. Ron became very excited when he first saw the basket and was convinced she was actually giving out gold. "You see the numerals around the edge of the coins?" Hermione said, holding one up for examination at the end of their 4th meeting. The coin gleamed fat and yellow in the light from the torches. "On real galleons, that's just a serial number, referring to the goblin who cast the coin. On these fake coins, though, the numbers will change to reflect the time and date of the next meeting. The coins will grow hot when the date changes, so if you're carrying them in a pocket, you'll be able to feel them. We take 1 each, and when Harry sets the date of the next meeting, he'll change the numbers on his coin. And because I've put a protean charm on them, they'll all change to mimic his." A blank silence greeted Hermione's words. She looked around at all the faces upturned to her, rather disconcerted. "Well, I thought it was a good idea," she said uncertainly. "I mean, even if Umbridge asked us to turn out our pockets, there's nothing fishy about carrying a galleon, is there? But, well, if you don't want to use them..." "You can do a protean charm," said Terry Boot. "Yes," said Hermione. "But that's N.E.W.T. standard, that is," he said weakly. "Oh," said Hermione, trying to look modest. "Oh, well, yes, I suppose it is." "How come you're not in Ravenclaw?" he demanded, staring at Hermione with something close to wonder. "With brains like yours." "Well, the Sorting Hat did seriously consider putting me in Ravenclaw during my sorting," said Hermione brightly, "but it decided on Gryffindor in the end. So, does that mean we're using the galleons?" There was a murmur of assent, and everybody moved forwards to collect one from the basket. Harry looked sideways at Hermione. "You know what these remind me of?" "No, what's that?" "The Death Eater's scars. Voldemort touches one of them, and all their scars burn, and they know they've got to join him." "Well, yes," said Hermione quietly. "That is where I got the idea. But you'll notice I decided to engrave the date on bits of metal, rather than on our members' skin." "Yeah, I prefer your way," said Harry, grinning, as he slipped his galleon into his pocket. "I suppose the only danger with these is that we might accidentally spend them." "Fat chance," said Ron, who was examining his own fake galleon with a slightly mournful air. "I haven't got any real galleons to confuse it with." As the first Quidditch match of the season, Gryffindor versus Slytherin, drew nearer, their DA meetings were put on hold because Angelina insisted on almost daily practices. The fact that the Quidditch Cup had not been held for so long added considerably to the interest and excitement surrounding the forthcoming game. The Ravenclaws and Hufflepuffs were taking a lively interest in the outcome, for they, of course, would be playing both teams over the coming year, and the heads of house of the competing teams, though they attempted to disguise it under a decent pretence of sportsmanship, were determined to see their own side victorious. Harry realised how much Professor McGonagall cared about beating Slytherin when she abstained from giving them homework in the week leading up to the match. "I think you've got enough to be getting on with at the moment," she said loftily. Nobody could quite believe their ears until she looked directly at Harry and Ron and said grimly, "I've become accustomed to seeing the Quidditch Cup in my study, boys, and I really don't want to have to hand it over to Professor Snape, so use the extra time to practice, won't you?" Snape was no less obviously partisan. He had booked the Quidditch pitch for Slytherin practice so often that the Gryffindors had difficulty getting on it to play. He was also turning a deaf ear to the many reports of Slytherin attempts to hex Gryffindor players in the corridors. When Alicia Spinett turned up in the hospital wing with her eyebrows growing so thick and fast they obscured her vision and obstructed her mouth, Snape insisted that she must have attempted a hair-thickening charm on herself, and refused to listen to the 14 eyewitnesses who insisted they had seen the Slytherin keeper, Miles Bletchley, hit her from behind with a jinx while she worked in the library. Harry felt optimistic about Gryffindor's chances. They had, after all, never lost to Malfoy's team. Admittedly, Ron was still not performing to Wood's standard, but he was working extremely hard to improve. His greatest weakness was a tendency to lose confidence after he had made a blunder. If he let in one goal, he became flustered, and was therefore likely to miss more. On the other hand, Harry had seen Ron make some truly spectacular saves when he was on form. During one memorable practice, he had hung one-handed from his broom, and kicked the quaffle so hard away from the goal hoop that it soared the length of the pitch and through the centre hoop at the other end. The rest of the team felt this save compared favourably with one made recently by Barry Ryan, the Irish international keeper, against Poland's top chaser, Ladislav Zamoyski. Even Fred had said that Ron might yet make him and George proud, and that they were seriously considering admitting he was related to them, something they assured him they had been trying to deny for 4 years. The only thing really worrying Harry was how much Ron was allowing the tactics of the Slytherin team to upset him before they even got onto the pitch. Harry, of course, had endured their snide comments for over 4 years, so whispers of, "Hey, Potty, I heard Warrington sworn to knock you off your broom on Saturday," far from chilling his blood, made him laugh. "Warrington's aim so pathetic, I'd be more worried if he was aiming for the person next to me," he retorted, which made Ron and Hermione laugh and wiped the smirk off Pansy Parkinson's face. But Ron had never endured a relentless campaign of insults, jeers and intimidation. When Slytherins, some of them seventh years and considerably larger than he was, muttered as they passed in the corridors, "Got your bed booked in the hospital wing, Weasley?" he didn't laugh, but turned a delicate shade of green. When Draco Malfoy imitated Ron dropping the quaffle, which he did whenever they came within sight of each other, Ron's ears glowed red, and his hands shook so badly that he was likely to drop whatever he was holding at the time, too. October extinguished itself in a rush of howling winds and driving rain, and November arrived, cold as frozen iron, with hard frosts every morning and icy draughts that bit at exposed hands and faces. The skies and the ceiling of the great hall turned a pale, pearly grey. The mountains around Hogwarts were snow-capped, and the temperature in the castle dropped so low that many students wore their thick, protective dragon-skin gloves in the corridors between lessons. The morning of the match dawned bright and cold. When Harry awoke, he looked round at Ron's bed, and saw him sitting bolt upright, his arms around his knees, staring fixedly into space. "You all right?" said Harry. Ron nodded, but did not speak. Harry was reminded forcibly of the time Ron had accidentally put a slug-vomiting charm on himself. He looked just as pale and sweaty as he had done then, not to mention as reluctant to open his mouth. "You just need some breakfast," Harry said bracingly. "Come on." The great hall was filling up fast when they arrived, the talk louder and the mood more exuberant than usual. As they passed the Slytherin table, there was an upsurge of noise. Harry looked round and saw that, in addition to the usual green and silver scarves and hats, every one of them was wearing a silver badge in the shape of what seemed to be a crown. For some reason, many of them waved at Ron, laughing uproariously. Harry tried to see what was written on the badges as he walked by, but he was too concerned to get Ron past their table quickly to linger long enough to read them. They received a rousing welcome at the Gryffindor table, where everyone was wearing red and gold, but far from raising Ron's spirits, the cheers seemed to sap the last of his morale. He collapsed onto the nearest bench, looking as though he were facing his final meal. "I must have been mental to do this," he said in a croaky whisper. "Mental!" "Don't be thick," said Harry firmly, passing him a choice of cereals. "You're going to be fine. It's normal to be nervous."
"I'm rubbish," croaked Ron. "I'm lousy. I can't play to save my life. What was I thinking?"
"Get a grip," said Harry sternly. "Look at that save you made with your foot the other day. Even Fred and George said it was brilliant." Ron turned a tortured face to Harry. "That was an accident," he whispered miserably. "I didn't mean to do it. I slipped off my broom when none of you were looking, and when I was trying to get back on, I kicked the quaffle by accident."
"Well,"
said Harry, recovering quickly from this unpleasant surprise, "a few more accidents like that, and the game is in the bag, isn't it?" Hermione and Ginny sat down opposite them, wearing red and gold scarves, gloves and rosettes. "How are you feeling?" Ginny asked Ron, who was now staring into the dregs of milk at the bottom of his empty cereal bowl, as though seriously considering attempting to drown himself in them. "He's just nervous," said Harry.
"Well, that's a good sign. I never feel you perform as well in exams if you're not a bit nervous," said Hermione heartily.
"Hello?" said a vague and dreamy voice from behind them. Harry looked up. Luna Lovegood had drifted over from the Ravenclaw table. Many people were staring at her, and a few were openly laughing and pointing. She had managed to procure a hat shaped like a life-size lion's head, which was perched precariously on her head. "I'm supporting Gryffindor," said Luna, pointing unnecessarily at her hat. "Look what it does." She reached up and tapped the hat with her wand. It opened its mouth wide and gave an extremely realistic roar that made everyone in the vicinity jump.
"It's good, isn't it?" said Luna happily. "I wanted to have it chewing up a serpent, to represent Slytherin, you know. But there wasn't time. Anyway, good luck, Ronald."
She drifted. They had not quite recovered from the shock of Luna's hat before Angelina came hurrying towards them, accompanied by Katie and Alicia, whose eyebrows had mercifully been returned to normal by Madame Pumphrey.
"When you're ready," she said, "we're going to go straight down to the pitch, check out conditions, and change."
"We'll be there in a bit," Harry assured her. "Ron's just got to have some breakfast."
It became clear after 10 minutes, however, that Ron was not capable of eating anything more, and Harry thought it best to get him down to the changing rooms. As they rose from the table, Hermione got up too, and taking Harry's arm, she drew him to one side.
"Don't let Ron see what's on those Slytherin's badges," she whispered urgently.
Harry looked questioningly at her, but she shook her head warningly. Ron had just ambled over to them, looking lost and desperate.
"Good luck, Ron," said Hermione,
standing on tiptoe and kissing him on the cheek.
"And you, Harry."